The podcast network is supported by Neo.org, a social network with a purpose, to transform the world by enabling people to transform themselves. And Tony Kynaston, our first TPN patron. Become a TPN patron or a member of the TPN 500 by visiting tpn.thepodcastnetwork.com.
There's a way, such a better way, today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today there's a better way.
Hello, this is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 149. And with me tonight, I have the largest panel I've ever tried to invite to an Atomic Show. I have on the line with me today Robert Margolis, Meredith Angwin, who blogs at Yes Vermont Yankee, Kelly Taylor, David Bradish, who's one of the NEI Nuclear Notes bloggers, Charles Barton, who blogs at Nuclear Green and Energy from Thorium, and Dan Yerman, who blogs at Idaho Samizdat. Welcome to you all tonight.
Thanks, Rod.
Thanks.
Okay, who was that first one?
This is Robert. This is Robert Margolis. For those who may not have heard on the podcast before, I've been in the industry 23 years, and I'm a nuclear engineer and have worked in nuclear power on three continents, and currently working in Florida.
Okay, Meredith?
Yes, this is Meredith Angwin. I'm blogging at Yes Vermont Yankee. I live in Vermont. I used to work at EPRI in the steam generator project office, and then I had my own company consulting with EPRI and nuclear utilities.
Hi, my name is Kelly Taylor. I have 24 years experience in nuclear power, including operations, engineering, and consulting work, and I'm delighted to be here. You're a brave man, Rod.
Hi, this is David Bradish, and I'm probably the youngest one on this. Only been in industry for about 5 years, but my role at the Nuclear Energy Institute is data and statistics.
Yeah, but David, how long have you been in the nuclear family?
Oh, born into it. my dad and brother both work at the largest nuke plant, and my mom, she used to work at the Idaho lab.
And if I recall correctly, your mom was the first woman ever qualified to operate a nuclear reactor in the United States.
Yes, she was the first first reactor operator at I believe what they called E. And Dan could correct me on this, EGNG, I believe, was the name of the company back then.
That's correct, David.
Oh, that is awesome.
All right, Charles.
This is Charles Barton from Nuclear Green. I was not quite born into the nuclear business, but I joined it, I guess, when I was 6 years old with my father. Went to work in Oak Ridge. He went on to make a major contribution to the light water reactor technology, nuclear safety, and of course spent 20 years working on molten salt reactor technology. So one of my major interests is in molten salt reactors, or lifters as we now call them.
This is Dan Yerman. I recently retired after 19 years at the Idaho National Laboratory in Idaho Falls, where I worked on business development and technology commercialization in the nuclear field. And I blog at Idaho Samizdat and generally cover the business and economic and political angles of the nuclear industry at that blog.
Well, welcome to you all, and thank you for volunteering to spend some time with me this evening. I think that I may be one of the more excited people in the country these days, having heard the president say very clearly that he intends to use building new nuclear power plants as one of the economic engines that will get America working again and position us to be exporters. So I know that I've read several articles over the last couple of days talking about those who are in favor of this plan and those who are perhaps not so in favor. So I'd like to hear some thoughts from you all about what do you think this statement in the State of the Union address, which is, as some people dismiss it, is just a speech, really means.
This is Robert. Of course, the articles have followed on that there's some story that he's going to increase the loan guarantees from the $18.5 billion to $54 billion, as well as, of course, having named the Blue Ribbon Panel. Of course, when I heard about the loan guarantees, I'll simply say I hope that it simply doesn't become a larger political football for OMB and DOE to fight over, that it actually also means that they move forward with them.
Okay, folks. I know that there's a lot of folks. Go ahead.
I'm trying to be quick because I know.
Okay. This is Dan. New York Times confirmed on the 30th, an article by Matthew Wald, that the budget that will be released tomorrow will contain the measure expanding the loan guarantees. I think it's important not just to concern ourselves with people who will oppose it, but also take a look at why he did propose it. There's a very interesting ABC television news poll on support for nuclear energy, and it shows sharp divisions in the United States in terms of support and opposition. According to pollster Gary Langer at ABC television news, the partisan divisions are most critical. 61% of Republicans support it. Only 23% of Democrats support it. Seniors support nuclear energy by an enormous margin, 67%. 28% oppose it. Also, young adults who were a critical part of Obama's electoral base oppose nuclear energy by similar margins. And what this means, I think, according – and Langer says this, and I agree with him – he concludes that Obama's support for nuclear energy is a calculated political call to groups that are outside of his political base, because this support will appeal to them and give them a reason to pay attention to his administration's policies, which include climate change and legislation that's now pending in the Senate.
Do we have a good feel for why young adults would oppose nuclear power? That surprises me, considering the nuclear events that I've been to. Even my children pointed out to me the people that came up to the microphone at public hearings and stuff to speak in opposition were usually gray-haired. So it's been my anecdotal experience that it's an older generation that generally opposes nuclear and the younger embraces it. So to hear you, if I understood you correctly, to hear you say differently is a surprise to me.
Yeah, I did mention that according to this poll, young adults oppose nuclear energy perhaps by two-thirds majority, according to this poll. Of course, it's only one poll, we'd have to see others. But I think one thing you need to look at is the crossover among young adults who supported Obama and their engagement in environmental groups. So I think that's one possible source, but there could be others.
Well, of course, it's always also very critical to know what question was asked in that poll. You can get almost any answer you want depending on how you ask a question in a poll. But I think it's very interesting to think that seniors, the people who were around at a time closest to when the bomb actually happened and when they were actually taught in school to duck and cover, have a much more favorable view of nuclear energy. Because a lot of us tell ourselves that the reason people are afraid of nuclear energy is because they're worried about the bomb. So that's an interesting dichotomy.
Well, and not only that, but the lifter community is getting a lot of support from younger people. If you go on Twitter and look for thorium messages, you get a whole lot of them. So it may be if you ask them do you support nuclear? They'll say no. And do you support thorium? They'll say yes.
Yeah, well, I know that many people are interested in things that they think are new and forward-looking technologies, and some young people may consider that traditional nuclear power is something old, although I keep reminding folks that the wind and sun have been around a heck of a lot longer than humans have known about fission.
Well, yes, Wilder magazine says uranium is so 20th century.
I think these political divisions, if they're real, are also something to look at, because they represent gaps in terms of the nuclear industry wanting to address them. While Obama has reached out to these groups because they support nuclear energy, it's also crucial to keep in mind that the nuclear industry has to cast their net in all directions. And so if these groups have strong preferences the other way, I think it's probably going to be a challenge to the nuclear industry to try and reach them.
Well, in some ways, I believe that Obama, as a strong liberal Democrat, stepping up and saying that he wants to build new nuclear power plants is almost on the same scale as Nixon going to China, because it doesn't really make much didn't really make much difference, obviously, for George Bush or Ronald Reagan to step up and say that they were in favor of nuclear, because people assumed that they were. It makes a much bigger difference when somebody who is the spokesman for those who are traditionally considered to be opposed steps up and says, hey, let's take a look at this thing, because I really don't think that the opposition in most cases is all that strong. I think many cases people will say they're against it simply because they don't understand.
Well, I think in response to your comments, Ron, Nixon went to China because he could no longer contain it. And so realistic politics, which is what he practiced, said he now had to engage it. I think that metaphor carries with regard to Obama and nuclear energy. For a long time, a lot of us felt that he wasn't going to say anything about nuclear energy because the green wing of the Democratic Party was so vociferous in pushing solar and wind and other renewable technologies. The thing to keep in mind about Obama is he comes from Illinois, which has more nuclear plants, I think, in one state than any others. And he got considerable campaign contributions from the nuclear industry when he was running for president. So sooner or later, he was going to have to engage with the nuclear industry. I just think it's spectacular the way he's done it.
I came from Illinois, and it's very much a coal country, too, you know. So that's one of the things I find difficult up here in Vermont. The idea is that the Vermont Yankee plant is single-handedly preventing renewables. And I keep saying, no, it's nuclear versus coal. And people look at me like I'm a little strange. I think that is a message the nuclear industry has not gotten out there.
Well, there's a good reason for that, Meredith, because there really is no nuclear industry at this point.
Right.
Almost every single large company involved in nuclear has almost as big, if not larger, an investment in coal and natural gas.
Or
windmills.
Divided against itself.
If you're General Electric, you make more money selling windmills today than you make selling nuclear plant components.
Yeah, so a house divided against itself can't stand. So the people who are investing like hard dollars in nuclear electricity are the same people that get those dollars from fossil fuels. They see the benefits of nuclear, but they're not going to cut their nose off to spite their face because it's all one company. They're not going to create a war within their own house.
Well, they're looking to. They would, I guess, one could say they would look for, shall we say, the easy way is they can use nuclear and continue the markets in places where it's continues to be easier to use those other fuels.
The problem the Obama administration faces is that it is unlikely that they're going to get the sort of renewable penetration into the generation electrical generation industry that's necessary to go to post-carbon transition.
It's not unlikely. It's impossible.
Yes, it's impossible.
I don't understand why people are so afraid to speak up and say you cannot produce reliable electricity using the sun, which sets every night, and the wind, which only blows on occasion. It just will not work. And then
right.
people step up and say, well, we'll just connect large areas. Well, I'm sorry, but if we don't have a grid like that, and transmission lines don't go up for free.
Well, now remember, Rod, there's still a... I was just going to say, Rod, just remember, there's still a lot of people who believe in cold fusion also, so it's sometimes hard to convince within the members of the general public, especially, you know, someone gets a sunburn and they think, gee, the sun is very powerful. Of course, no one gets a sunburn at night, but everyone keeps thinking, oh, well, if you just make a better battery or if somebody comes up with some great invention that, you know, can store electricity really cheap, and then it would be just so easy. And I think it's just, again, I think as some of the other panelists have indicated, you know, folks just don't understand a lot of how electricity is made and distributed.
Right. And if I was 8 foot tall, I could dunk a basketball. But I'm not.
When I meet people that talk about how great wind energy is and you don't have to spend anything on the fuel cost, things like that, I do an internet search and I refer them to an annual report from, I think, 2005 from a German company called E.ON. And the annual report is printed in English, which is what makes it such a handy reference. But basically, E.ON was committed to renewable resources and specifically to becoming the largest wind company in the world. And they were actually really successful along those lines. So if you want to take on that mantle, then you should learn from the leaders that have headed out in that direction. And in their 2005 annual report, it is just filled, rife with details about how Germany is basically causing electricity problems in other nations like Denmark and stuff like that, because when the wind blows, it blows, and they end up with more free electricity that they can't charge for because there's no market for, so they ship it out to Denmark and they ship it out to wherever they can, basically to avoid overloading their own grid because they can't control when the wind blows. And mentally, when you have a picture of how this works, you figure, well, you have peak periods and you have lull periods and stuff like that, and the electricity, you just expect the electric companies to cope with that. But in this annual report, it said the difference in calendar dates between the maximum wind output and the minimum output is like 2 days. So, you know, it's either all or nothing. And although they got very good at wind forecasting, it's not good enough to be able to compensate with their fossil stations and everything else that they can use to balance the grid and smooth over the peaks and valleys for it. And even if they could, ramping fossil stations up and down that much is wasted energy. It increases the emissions that those fossil stations are putting out in the atmosphere compared to what they would be if they were running on a more even power curve.
Yeah, and it also puts an awful lot of wear and tear on those machines. Steam turbines and gas turbines are machines that can run for very long periods of time at steady state. But if you cycle them, the maintenance cost goes through the roof.
Right.
I'm speaking from experience here.
And none of those costs get counted against the wind turbines and stuff that are the reason why they're cycling so much. You know, you get the clean slate for, oh, the fuel cost is zero, and then you don't have to count the expenses that you're adding to the other power stations to compensate for the ups and downs of when the wind's not blowing.
Well, I did an analysis a few weeks ago of a new study of 20% and 30% wind penetration of the Eastern Interconnect. And what that study showed is that with 20% wind penetration, the cost of electricity goes up. And with 30% penetration, it goes up even more. Wind penetration does make the cost of electricity rise. And in addition, of course, you have to have a very large expansion of the grid, and you have to have natural gas turbine backup, which means that you're emitting CO2 in support of the wind penetration.
So, Dan, getting back to your analogy between Nixon going to China, or my analogy, I should say, your comment of it about Nixon going to China and Obama coming to nuclear, is I believe that the calculus is fairly similar. Nixon recognized that not dealing with China was unrealistic in a forward-looking environment, and I believe that Obama recognized that trying to solve energy problems without nuclear was an unrealistic plan.
Well, I think also he also needs to try to find some way to get the Senate Republican leadership to stop being the party of no, because they've been very successful with that strategy in blocking his legislative initiatives. And he may have actually achieved some progress, because late on Friday, Senator Lamar Alexander, Republican from Tennessee and chairman of the Senate Republican Conference, issued a statement endorsing Chu's formation of the Blue Ribbon Commission and also the expansion of the loan guarantees. That's a clear signal from Alexander that he's willing to have dialogue and maybe step out in front of the solid wall of Republican opposition to Obama's legislative initiatives. And if he moves, since he's the chairman of the Republican Conference, others may follow. And with the change in the arithmetic in the Senate as a result of the Massachusetts election, Obama needs people moving across the aisle more than ever. So there's a possibility that this was an astute political move, and it follows your metaphor exactly.
Well, I also believe that if you look, pay attention to the rest of the State of the Union address, and President Obama made some clear statements about the difference between leadership and actually governing the country and playing politics. And I believe that this is one of those instances where he's talking about this is something we can work on together. And, oh, by the way, I believe that President Obama and even some of his folks in OMB have recognized that loan guarantees are really inexpensive way for the government to enable a whole bunch of new jobs, because the money doesn't come out of government coffers.
Well, as a matter of fact, they can charge money for the guarantee. They can,
there's a very substantial premium. In fact, one of the things that has delayed the issuance of the loan guarantees is that the legislation only gives the government one chance to set the risk premium for the loan guarantees. And the difficulty, I've had some conversations with people who are deeply involved in supporting the government in carrying out these calculations. Unfortunately, that's off the record, so I can't go into too much detail. But what it boils down to is that the federal law, the Energy Policy Act, is very prescriptive in requiring the government to make a calculation of how much premium to charge for how much risk. And because there are no precedents for this, at least at this scale and with this technology, and given the fact that no one has built a nuclear plant for 30 years, there's a lot of uncertainty. So OMB is kind of over a barrel, because they've got this legislative set of drivers, and the Energy Department is over a barrel because they have enormous pressure from the industry and Congress to get the loan guarantees out the door. The industry has told both parties, if you set these premiums too high, we will walk away and your loan guarantees will be worthless. And this is why Secretary Chu complained publicly the other day that getting the loan guarantees was, quote, very complicated. That's what he was talking about.
Yeah, he mentioned there was a lot of stakeholders involved, and he was, of course, somewhat surprised by the intensity of the discussions. But we're talking about some very large dollar amounts here. I think the variations that I've read on the fees is somewhere between 1 and 10% of the face value of the loan, which is pretty significant for a $10 billion loan.
Well, that's right. And here's the thing that has made people nervous recently, and that is that NRG's project down at the South Texas project, which is one of the shortlisted projects has become embroiled in a terribly complicated set of controversies with their investors, with the reactor manufacturer who's also going to build the plant. And on Friday this week, NRG had a conference call in which they said that if two things don't happen, they will simply take a $400 million charge and stop the project. The first is that they get the loan guarantee, and the second is that CPS Energy stop trying to negotiate with them through the news media and you know, come to the table and step up to their commitment for a 20% share. And at one point, CPS had an option to do a 40% share, but they've backed out of that. So, by the way, Comanche Peak is the runner-up, number five runner-up, and if NRG drops off, they get to move up on the short list. But this has happened very quickly. The controversy developed during the fall when Toshiba said that they had a rough order of magnitude increase in the cost of the reactor. They weren't sure about it, but until an EPC contract was signed, they were going with their best numbers. CPS Energy didn't handle the communication of that information with the city council in San Antonio very well. It blew up in everybody's face. It got ugly very quickly. The executive director of CPS Energy, who was in interim status, resigned. Then CPS filed litigation against NRG. The mayor tried to mediate it. He was unsuccessful. And now NRG is saying, you know, if you guys can't come to terms with us, we're just not going to build this thing. I think that probably is posturing because they do have made claim previously that they have other investors who will step up to this. But this has given some people in Washington some pause. This is a jeepers. We've done all this due diligence on these four companies, and all of a sudden this thing blows up like fireworks on the 4th of July. Are these other guys subject to them? Answer is probably not. The other three shortlisted companies are not facing similar difficulties. They include Constellation for Calvert Cliffs 3, Scana for VC Summer Station, and Southern for the Vogtle plant. All of those are a much more stable situation. In fact, Constellation, Rod, you probably can comment on this, recently got clear of controversy with the Maryland Public Utilities Commission on EDF's investment. And I think both Southern and Scana have signed EPC contracts for their Westinghouse AP1000s. So that represents a very strong commitment there.
EDF, Electricity de France, not EDS. But yes, up until just a month or so ago, I would have put Constellation's bid at not quite the same level of uncertainty as the NRG bid, but there was a lot of political discussion going on here in Maryland because Constellation is not terribly popular here. But it was just about 3 years ago that a rate freeze that had been in place since the deregulation period ended, and Constellation's immediate action was to increase the price of electricity by 110%. We jumped up from 6 cents a kilowatt hour to about 12.4 cents a kilowatt hour in one fell swoop. So that was didn't make Constellation the most popular poster child in the state of Maryland.
I did. I think the Skype here probably cut off my last consonant there. I did say EDF. Now, it became very controversial because opponents of the acquisition of 49% share of Constellation's asset by EDF, got the F word in there this time, was very controversial. And opponents tried to say, hey, a foreign power is, you know, trying to take over our utilities. You know, that's a lot of hooey, but it's just another opportunity for someone to kick up some dust. In fact, they're going to build an Areva EPR at Calvert Cliffs 3.
And they may get some money from the French government as well.
Right. But here's the interesting thing. A lot of the components are going to come from a new factory that Areva is building with Northrop Grumman at Newport News. 500 American jobs are going to be created at that facility, and it's going to be one of the main suppliers of pumps and valves and everything else that makes a reactor run. So you have to step back and say, you know, the supply chain is going to have a very strong American component.
Right. And the supply chain from Northrop Grumman, Newport News, to Calvert Cliffs is very short. It's a very nice ride up to Chesapeake Bay from Norfolk up to Calvert Cliffs. So that's going to be a nice transport.
When the steam generators take the barge trip, I'm expecting to see pictures on your blog, Rod.
well, you're probably correct, but it will be because I'm in the Norfolk area visiting my granddaughter, and I'll go visit my friends at Areva Northrop Grumman. But anyway, okay. Hey, David, you've been very quiet. So what's going on in the in your world? Do you see some cheering?
Oh man, I gotta tell you, last week at NEI, we were all just—it was pretty exciting. It was Wednesday when the State of the Union was going on. I was watching it at home with my wife, and I just—I kept hearing them say, "Oh yeah, we got to invest in clean energy." And I'm thinking, he's ramping it up. Come on, go nuclear, say nuclear. You know, he's kind of ramping up on this. And then I heard it, and we all heard it, and then you know, the Republicans just jumped right on up and. Many of the Democrats jumped right up. I'm like, oh, this is going to be great. And then Thursday, we had a lot of media discussion going on. We had a lot of people calling in. Friday was even another day with the loan guarantees and the announcement of the commission. And then it was just a crazy, crazy week at NEI. Great, good week. Probably one of the pinnacles that I've been there of excitement. And I'm looking at the members of the commission that were picked, and I'm even more excited about it because I'm seeing some very diverse positions on this. You have politicians, but then you also have experts like from MIT, like Ernie Moniz. You have utility exec John Rowe representing, and you have a pretty balanced group of people. Who are hopefully going to make a good decision and some good policy recommendations that, you know, I don't know if you could really get much better with a different group of people in the office, different group of people in the administration.
Yeah, I
agree
with you.
But we're all pretty pumped here.
I've read some folks in the blogging world who are concerned because they didn't have enough scientists and engineers, but My response is this is not a science or engineering problem. This is very much a political problem because we know how to store waste. It's simple. You put it in a concrete and steel container.
Oh, yeah.
You stick it above ground. And if the container has a problem, you fix it.
Well, there's more.
And it's all about shaping policy.
There's more going on, though. It's also, in a sense, going to be setting research priorities. And we've already had some decisions. We're not going to dig a hole and put the waste in the ground. Apparently we're not going to put it into integral fast reactors either. That apparently has been decided by.
I don't think so.
Why was that? How was that decided?
Well, this is the story that came out in Defense Daily on the 15th, and I think Dan wrote about it.
I think it's important, Charles, if I could just jump in here, that the budget decision on nuclear R&D is unrelated to the charter for the Blue Ribbon Panel. The Blue Ribbon Panel has a very clear charter to address the use of fast reactors. Whether or not the government supports that with money is an entirely separate decision. And, of course, that schism, that gap there, is very visible, as you're correctly pointing out.
Well, and don't forget that story in Energy Daily came out, and the budget has not been submitted yet. That is a story that came out that was about an agency head having a disagreement with the Office of Management and Budget, which is something that happens all the time during the normal federal budget preparation. And until the budget's actually released, the decision has not been made by the decision maker. So it's interesting to watch that and see the kind of correspondence that goes on between agency heads and the folks that control the budget. But it's not a decision.
One of the things I think about this panel that's very important, there's been some comment about whether or not this panel is coming from is a political panel or technical panel. I think it's primarily a policy-level panel based on the kinds of people who are there. But I have a concern about it. The first is that there was a long period of time when the panel wasn't being named. One of the things that came out in the New York Times was that Secretary Chu was having a hard time getting people to sign on because Yucca had been taken off the table. Now, presumably, the folks who are on the panel now don't have any qualms about that. But the real test, the first test of this panel, after its first meeting, is whether the members continue to do work or whether they send flunkies. Because that's how these blue ribbon commissions sometimes work. And my concern is if we see underlings, especially junior underlings, showing up for subsequent meetings, you know, I'm going to have some reservations about it.
Okay. I have a couple of questions because I'm not familiar with how blue ribbon panels work. I understand that they have a charter to focus on what the long-term solution is for the used nuclear fuel. Is that the limit of their charter, and do they have a time limit to deliver when they're supposed to be done with their research or their conclusions?
They have an interim report due in 18 months and a final report due in 24 months.
Yeah, that's right. The president actually issued a White House memo that lays out their charter, and it says basically the commission should consider a broad range of technological and policy alternatives. And it's very sweeping in its charter. It should analyze the scientific, environmental, budgetary. You can go to sleep reading all these terms here, but basically they're also allowed to propose new legislation. So this panel actually has a fairly sweeping charter. Now, the way these panels work typically, if you've ever watched the National Academy of Sciences do some of their studies for Congress, is that an expert staff is assembled. The principals will show up for the first meeting, lay out some markers, what their policy positions, their views are. The staff goes to work, and then the group reconvenes when a draft report is read. And there's a lot of back and forth that takes place outside of the public view. But this charter here is very sweeping. So I think that both fast reactors and other kinds of options are clearly going to be considered as part of what they do. And I think it's probably worth following. The bloggers community ought to try and find ways to stay in touch with how this panel is doing its work.
I have another question. For the policy historians in the group, was there ever a similar panel formed that came up with recommendations that eventually became the long-term repository that became narrowed down that grew into the Yucca Mountain thing that's since been canceled? Was this effort done prior to narrowing down the options of what to do with used fuel before we came up with the Yucca Mountain solution that's no longer viable?
Interestingly enough, it was the process was going on. There were a number of alternatives that had been proposed, including some salt caverns in the southeast and granite formations in Wisconsin and a few other places that people were proposing as possible solutions. Yucca Mountain was on the list. It was fairly low on the technical scale from the technical evaluators. However, it was already federal property, and it was in a state that only had, I believe at the time, one representative in the House of Representatives. So it was a political decision to eliminate all of the other alternatives on the list, which were from states with more population, and say, let's give it to Nevada, sort of like Mikey. At least that's the way I understand the history.
And that's consistent with my understanding also, but prior to that, prior to eliminating the other options and narrowing down to Yucca, prior to looking at sites that might have been appropriate to store used fuel in, was there something comparable to a blue ribbon panel that, for example, eliminated a deep sea repository because the fuel would not, you couldn't reclaim it and reuse it later? Was there something that that eliminated, you know, digging a really deep hole or shooting it into the sun, because these options were taken off the table, because then you wouldn't have access to the fuel as a resource for future generations.
Well, didn't they, of course, in 1957, the National Academy of Sciences endorsed deep, they endorsed the land-based repository.
I think to keep in mind, it takes a long time for the government to make up its mind about these kinds of things. A waste isolation pilot project in New Mexico, which currently takes low-level waste and remote-handled transuranic waste from various federal facilities, was originally proposed in 1955, and the first environmental impact statements on it weren't done until the late 1970s. So it took 20 years to get to a point where a formal decision process was involved. And at one time, WIPP was going to be a repository for high-level military waste, because we were still in the depths of the Cold War. So not only does the government take a long time to make up its mind, but it changes its mind while it's making up its mind.
Yeah.
I think sometimes
it waffles when it makes up its mind, like including the word pilot in a facility that is certainly not a pilot facility in terms of its space and capacity.
I'd like to ask a question to people who know more than me about the people on the panel. We had a independent safety assessment here for Vermont Yankee, and it included people who were reasonable nuclear people, and it included people who were violently anti-nuclear, like Arne Gunderson. And the net result was a report that they must have spent as much time wordsmithing that report so that it's almost exactly even. You know, it's very good about this, but it's terrible about that. You can read anything into it you want. And I just wondered about the people on this panel. Do you think that they can come up with a consensus that will be something readable and actually actionable?
Well, that depends on the staff, number one. But number two, there's no ringers on this panel. This is a high-powered group. Just to mention a couple of things, Susan Eisenhower has been involved with nuclear nonproliferation issues. Pete Domenici, of course, was the basically one of the most pro-nuclear people in the Senate for many years. Alison McFarland actually was one time under consideration to be on the NRC. Ernie Moniz has been involved in nuclear energy at MIT his much of his career. Per Peterson, the same at Berkeley. John Rowe, of course, at Exelon. And the two environmentalists, by the way, are very responsible. I met and worked with Jonathan Lash when he was at NRDC, when I was at EPA back in the 80s, and I found him to be very even-handed. I don't know Philip Sharp, but Resources for the Future is a very mainstream group and not given to extreme positions. So I think there's good balance here. People are highly qualified in their respective disciplines. So the president's got a good group here. They just have to do the work.
I also think, going on a little bit further, I've read recently that one item in the budget that will cause some folks to again say Obama's an anti-nuke is that it looks like he is going to remove the funding and stop the review process for the Yucca Mountain facility, which is a decision that I cheer, because I think it's a waste of time and resources, particularly a waste of almost impossible to replace resources known as NRC licensed reviewers.
Well, and it's a waste of material resources too, because what is called nuclear waste actually contains valuable materials. And if we're going to have Generation 4 reactors, essential materials. Basically, at the moment, the LIFTR people and the IFR people are having a sub rosa war over that material, that reactor grade plutonium, because both coveted it as startup charges for their respective reactors.
Ah, there's plenty to go around. Don't worry about it. The U.S. government's got a store of 34 tons of plutonium that somebody's trying to figure out a way to dispose of. Don't worry about having enough charges.
Those fast reactors take an amazing amount of plutonium. They take 12 times as much plutonium per megawatt as molten salt reactors.
Yeah, but 34 tons is an awful lot of material.
I think the 34 tons figure is actually the amount that's going to be going through the Savannah River MOX fuel facility. The Russians are committed to blend an equal amount at a similar facility as part of a nuclear non-proliferation agreement between the two countries. That facility will begin production in 2016. It's now under construction by Areva Shaw MOX Services, if I think I have the name right. Maybe it's the other company first. Forgive me if I've got that backwards. but in any case, that is weapons-grade plutonium, and it's very pure and very easy to blend into MOX fuel. When you get into making MOX fuel from spent nuclear fuel, you're into a different metallurgical and chemical environment, I think we're going to hopefully see that R&D money restored, because if it isn't, it's going to be a long time before we see commercial MOX production from non-weapons-grade plutonium taking place in the United States.
Yeah, but see, the best news out of all that is, what would you rather have done with your nuclear weapons except to make electricity out of them?
Absolutely. Oh, let's beat those swords into plowshares, man.
Exactly.
Okay, I've got another topic that I want to bring up before we run out of time here. There's a lot of folks, as you all know, who will grasp at any straws and try to use those straws to beat up the nuclear industry. And I think it's important for us all to, in many cases, not roll over, not offend anybody, but certainly fight back with numbers. And Meredith is involved in a discussion on a plant. You know, she blogs at a blog called Yes Vermont Yankee. You know, right now that plant supplies about one third of the electricity for the state of Vermont. Yet there are folks that want to shut it down and are now using what I have calculated to be an incredibly tiny quantity of tritium as a excuse to call the people who operate that plant liars when they say that they don't have any tritium leaks, because somebody found 28,000 picocuries of tritium in a groundwater sample. Do you guys know what a picocurie is?
5,000 picocuries per liter is salad oil.
Okay, a picocurie is 1 times 10 to the minus 12th curies. In order to have a full curie, you need a trillion picocuries. So 28,000 picocuries is a very small amount. And as a matter of fact, if it's tritium, in order to have a curie, all you need is 0.1 milligrams.
And tritium is not particularly dangerous material in terms of its what it does inside a human body.
No.
The thing it does is that it goes out very quickly for the most part.
Yeah, and it's a very weak beta emitter. If you read essentially the material hazard safety sheets for tritium, and you compare that to gasoline, tritium is far less dangerous than gasoline, but is it possible to measure gasoline at a concentration of 1 out of every 10 to the 14th atoms?
Probably.
Now, Rod, you have to remember, though, of course, that if you are killed by radiation, you are far more dead than if you're killed by gasoline.
Really?
Absolutely.
And of course, the scary thing is that radiation causes cancer, right? What does it say on my gasoline pump? It says if I expose myself to it.
Everybody knows plutonium is one of the deadliest substances known to man. So, like, if you add up everybody that's ever died from plutonium, if you can find anybody, they must be way more dead than anybody else you know.
Have you guys ever heard of the IPPU group? Let me say that again.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Have you ever heard of the IPPU group?
No.
During the bomb programs, there were a number of people, some were close to 24, who, for one reason or another, ingested, I think the lowest number was 2 times the lethal dose, and the highest number was about 10 times the, quote, lethal dose of plutonium. So these folks were under study for many years, and they called themselves IPPU, because PU is the atomic symbol for plutonium.
Okay, I get the
I finally got it.
And when I was doing the research on these guys in 1998, only two of them had passed away at that point. They
Out
all
of
were
how many?
Exposed. Well, 25. They were all exposed in the 1940s to plutonium at a 2 to 10 times lethal dose.
Oh, Rod, keep in mind, from an epidemiological point of view, plutonium is going to be treated by the body as a heavy metal. It's going to impact the kidneys if you can get them to pass the metal out of their system relatively quickly. Then the resident time for the radiation in the body is relatively low, regardless of the dose. On the other hand, inhalation, where you get an alpha-emitting particle in the lung, it's going to stay there. And that, I think, really, you have to look at both inhalation and ingestion from the point of view of medical risk. It's a funny story, but one of the things we fail to take into account is science literacy in the U.S. is relatively low, and I think Meredith can probably testify that even the governor of Vermont lost his patience and made statements saying, I've lost my patience with Vermont Yankee over these very small amounts.
Well, there's actually two things going on. The first is the very small amounts, which nobody seems to get. They all seem to act as if this is a particularly dangerous situation for the groundwater, and I'm very tired of that. But there's also the question of were there tritium-containing pipes, and what were these? Were they underground pipes? Were they buried pipes? Did people say that they didn't have underground pipes when actually they did? And of course, it's very hard to figure out who said what to whom. And the other thing that's very difficult for me is that the antis keep saying, we asked them if there were underground pipes and they said there weren't. And I'm like, did you ever ask them for a piping diagram if you didn't believe them? And that doesn't seem to be anything that was ever asked.
Well, the reason I keep pointing back to this, the quantity, let me try to explain this. 1 trillion picocuries of tritium weighs 0.1 milligrams. In my cabinet, in my medicine cabinet, I have aspirin tablets which weigh 385 grams. So I would have to split an aspirin tablet into 3,050 pieces in order to find 1 trillion picocuries of tritium. So 28,000 picocuries of tritium is got to be an incredibly tiny quantity. How can you find that as a leak?
Well, one of the things that nuclear plants run into is that the construction methods at the time Vermont Yankee was built, was embedded piping in concrete, was considered to be okay. Today, if you're building a new plant, you wouldn't be allowed to embed the piping in concrete. All your piping would have to be visible. So it's quite possible that over time, as new pipes have been put in, as new cooling systems have been put in, as maintenance has occurred, that the drawings have become outdated, and it's quite possible that Vermont Yankee made an honest mistake and said, you know, we don't think we have any more of this stuff, only to be surprised by their own detection methods. So the issue of bad faith, I think, needs to be addressed, probably best by Vermont Yankee, of course. It was an excuse, by the way, for the antis to get out their hammers and bash the nail of anti-nuclear sentiment in Vermont, because they said, hey, this is bad faith and so forth and so on. And no one ever asked a question, wait a minute, you know, how did anyone detect this stuff, where is it coming from? And as Rod pointed out, these are very small amounts, and you are going to have a difficult time determining exactly where it's coming from.
Yeah, and you can you know, a water from the Great Lakes contains tritium, and you could get conceivably get some tritium in that tiny amount coming in from rain clouds that blow in to Vermont from the Lake Erie or Lake Ontario.
Okay, I'm going to propose something that probably many of you very factual and honest and good people would probably be shocked to hear. But if I went out and bought myself a tritium-containing light, you know, like an emergency light for an exit ramp or something like that, I could. I know of folks that used to be able to buy key fobs that glowed in the dark that contained a curie of tritium. Now, if I could find a curie of tritium...
I have one of those.
Yeah.
I don't know if it has that much, but I have one of those key fobs.
What if I wanted to shut down a nuclear power plant? And I could just ask a security guard...
Oh, God, don't even say this on the air. What is the matter with you?
No, I'm serious. Well, how hard would it be to contaminate the water at a nuclear power facility and shut down a multi-billion dollar asset because, my goodness, there must be a leak somewhere that we can't find.
Yeah, and you had that in India just a few months ago. You had somebody go in and dump some tritium into a water cooler.
And
all these workers were exposed to it.
Right, and nobody was hurt. I'm not saying this is not an act of hurting people. This is an act of scaring people to shut down billion-dollar facilities because people can't figure out that a small amount is a really small amount, and it's not going to hurt anybody. And there's certainly people who want to shut down this facility and who can make a lot of money if they shut down this facility.
Well, okay, that I think gets us into conspiracy theory. I'm not willing to go there, but let me reason by analogy about the issue of risk. You know, we read in the newspaper about airports that are shut down because some bozo went through the wrong security door, and so Newark Airport is shut down for 6 hours because some guy wanted to kiss his girlfriend goodbye. You have stuff like this that's taking place. I think the most interesting example of extreme response to risk took place in Fresno, California, where a man transporting 6 jars of honey, somehow the honey set off the dogs that were looking for doing bomb sniffing. 3 TSA guards complained of respiratory distress from the fumes and were taken to the hospital.
And every time they asked the guy what was in the jars, he said, "It's honey." So they incarcerated him, and they tested the contents of the jars, and they found out that he was transporting honey.
So our whole culture has an inability to deal with the concept of risk, to deal with the concept of risk perception, and this comes back to this issue of science literacy. As far as radiation is concerned, there's very simple principles: time, distance, and shielding. Anyone in the nuclear industry knows them. Somehow the nuclear industry has not been able to communicate effectively with the public on how you can safely manage radioactivity at any level of readings. And this is why the public perception meter pegged, even though the meter didn't.
Okay, so here's another thing to think about. One of the controversies going on in Vermont is the fact that Entergy, the owner of the plant, wants to include Vermont Yankee in a spinoff to a company called Enexis, which would, in fact, provide at least one company whose total focus is on producing electricity using nuclear energy alone. And the people in Vermont are very upset about the idea that their plant may become part of a nuclear-focused utility.
Well, part of the reason that that issue has been raised is that the anti-nuke groups in Vermont have made a great deal out of the impact of the stock market decline on Entergy's decommissioning fund for Vermont Yankee. In fact, the NRC issued a statement saying they were concerned about over a dozen plants that had been impacted that way, the same as people's savings, stocks, investments of 401ks have been impacted. But the NRC regulations are very clear. No matter where that plant goes in terms of its corporate structure, it has to comply with the regulations in terms of the integrity of the decommissioning funds. So that has been an opportunity for yet another angle of attack on the plant, when in fact it doesn't matter where it is in terms of the corporate world. It still has to have a viable decommissioning fund, or the NRC will step in.
Well, I say that a fair amount at various places, and so does my friend Howard Schaefer, but in all honesty, they just keep saying it's going to be owned by a company with debt and they'll just walk away from it. And then there's all this stuff about complete lies about Entergy walked away from everybody in Louisiana after Katrina, and it's just quite astonishing.
And that is definitely astonishing, because Entergy was one of the most responsible and generous employers in the entire region after Katrina.
Well, that's what I've heard too, but you wouldn't hear that from the people out here who are anti-nuclear. And the thing is, they repeat things over and over again, and it's sort of like anti-nuclear people are not Hitlerian, but the same kind of technique of, if you say something over and over again, even if it's a lie, people begin to say, oh yeah, I've heard that, that's right. You know, the Entergy will spin off Vermont Yankee, and then no one will pay for the decommissioning, no matter how often we say, no, you don't understand, the NRC will force people to pay for the decommissioning, whoever owns it. They say, oh yeah, you trust the NRC, ha. Huh? You know, I'm like...
Well, you know, it's completely illogical, because people say, well, we're worried about this plant not paying for its decommissioning, but we want to shut it down right now. Well, if you're really worried about it, whether it can pay for its decommissioning or not, you ought to let it run for a while and build up its fund. You know,
right.
How else do you make money? You run and you operate and you sell a product.
What a strange concept. No, Rod and everyone, I have to sign off. But I certainly appreciate being part of your hopefully record breaking group of podcasters, and look forward to another time.
Thanks for participating, Robert. Take care.
Okay. Bye.
Okay, now we can all talk about Robert.
Well, I think Robert's a great guy.
No, he is. I'm just teasing. So, Meredith, you know, how many discussions have you been in where folks have said, you know, we're not really happy about this this kind of spin-off company, the company that we don't know much about or whatever?
I've been in a lot of them, and as a matter of fact, I defend Vermont Yankee in many ways, and yet when people begin talking about the spin-off company, I just basically say, look, you know, that's up, whether that company is appropriate to run Vermont Yankee is up to the legislature, because the legislature of both Vermont and New York, but Indian Point would be in the same company, have to approve the spin-off, and the way it's financially structured and so forth, I don't really feel completely competent to say this is good, bad, or indifferent. I think I understand why they're doing it, and basically they want to have a bunch of merchant plants which are separately administered from the regulated plants. And I used to own a company. It was a very small company. There were about four of us, but we had both contracts which were subject to government-style auditing. What's your G&A? What's your overhead? We're coming in and checking your direct versus indirect hours. And others that just sort of wanted, like, pay me my invoices. And it was very hard. It was almost like keeping two sets of books. And I can imagine that it's the same for the big utility. with regulators and merchant plants. So I understand why they're doing it, but I don't understand everything about the structuring of it.
Well, I also think that there's some folks that are in Entergy who are very sharp folks. Remember, Entergy was one of the companies that recognized a long time ago that the fact that some people didn't want to operate their nuclear plants gave them an amazing opportunity to go in and buy a completely built facility for less than the value of the fuel that was on site. So there's some smart operators there. I believe that they're reading the tea leaves and thinking if they can focus and have a company that is tradable on the stock market, that is a completely focused nuclear operator, that as the country changes its mind about nuclear, that stock will be an extremely valuable stock and be bid up considerably.
I think actually that this is a good deal all the way around. You get a company whose business is operating power reactors. They're going to know more what they're doing than a company that owns one reactor or two reactors or three reactors. And so you're going to get better management. Reactors are owning a reactor is like owning a permit to print money.
Well,
I agree completely. They are, however, not putting all their nuclear plants into a nexus. They're only putting the northern nuclear plants that they expect to be merchant plants into a nexus.
Well, those plants are already merchant plants, right? I mean, Entergy already has five plants that are merchant plants, and the other plants in the south are still rate-regulated utility plants.
Right, right. It's hard for me to think of Vermont Yankee as a merchant plant, though it sells a lot of its power on the spot market, because when Entergy bought Vermont Yankee, they had to make certain power purchase agreements with the state, with the two biggest utilities in the state, which were approved by the state, which were almost like a regulated situation.
Right, and they're selling their...
In order to go deregulated, they had to first make long-term power sales contracts so that they get a big chunk of their stuff that's outside the spot market, so that the state's convinced that they'll have a steady rate for a long period of time.
Right, and I believe that steady rate was about 4 cents a kilowatt hour.
No, 4.2 cents per kilowatt hour. And then the Memorandum of Understanding said that if their license was renewed after 2012, they no longer had that 4 cents per kilowatt hour, but they had instead a revenue sharing agreement, which meant that if the price was cheap, the state paid the price. Okay, it was 4 or 5 cents a kilowatt hour. If the price went over 6.1 cents per kilowatt hour, the state would receive half of whatever it was above 6.1 cents. So but for 10 years rather than for 20. After 10 years, it became a straight merchant plant. But for 10 years, there was revenue sharing. And yet the people in the legislature kept wandering around saying, I shouldn't say they wandered around, but they were kind of, they kept saying, they won't give us a power purchase agreement. And I'm like, you have a memorandum of understanding. That is a contract, and it has a revenue sharing agreement instead of a power purchase agreement. I mean, you signed it,
because they don't know what the price is. You know, they don't have a quote unquote contract because they don't know what the price is. But they've already have the revenue sharing agreement in, regardless of what the price is.
That's right.
Yeah, they're covered.
That's what they had, but they insisted that Entergy was not negotiating with them. Entergy just wasn't negotiating, and they finally backed Entergy into a corner where it came up with a power purchase agreement of 6.1 cents. And then they say, well, that's too high. That's too high.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing considering the average price of electricity in New England is about 10 cents at the wholesale.
Yes, well, it has gone down drastically with the recession, though. It has gone down. It is more like 4 cents or 4 to 6 to 8 cents now. Now, we also buy here in Vermont, we buy Hydro-Quebec power at around 6 cents, and that contract runs out in 2016. Now, when we put that contract in place, from my perspective, Hydro-Quebec were the bad guys. They were the guys who had exploited the Cree Indians to build all these dams and flooded Virgin territory. Now they're the good guys because they have low-carbon power. And we have something called the RGGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which is a cap-and-trade system put in place in the New England states. And so if you don't have low-carbon power, you get to pay somebody.
Isn't Vermont the cleanest state in the Union?
Oh, it is. Absolutely.
When it comes to carbon production?
Yes, absolutely. In between Vermont Yankee and our own hydro up here, a little bit of it, and Hydro-Quebec, which is a third. It's like a third Vermont Yankee, a third Hydro-Quebec, a little bit of hydro, and pretty soon you just have only, you know, less than a third coming from fossil.
And you got some wood plants, too.
One of the things I think you're implying, and I just want to put a finer point on it, is where would the replacement power come from if Vermont Yankee were shut down? And to illustrate the point, I'm going to cite my friend Robert Hargraves, who has written about this in his online course at Dartmouth called Rethinking Nuclear. He asked the students to do a calculation of how methane from cows could be used to replace the power for Vermont Yankee. And the calculation came out, you would have to have 623 cows per square mile covering the entire state of Vermont in order to replace the power coming from Vermont Yankee.
I'm in a group with Bob Hargraves. It's called Coalition for Energy Solutions, and we've been working on a report to combat the VPIRG report, which basically said that you're going to replace Vermont Yankee with I don't know, something like 300 wind turbines. A huge number of square miles of solar panels, big new biomass things, power plants in the forest, and so forth. And really, it's all a phantasm. It's sort of like a daydream. I mean, these things are not practical.
Yep. Who's going to give up that much land in Vermont so that they can maintain their green stature as they are now?
Well, you know, if you go look at wind.
Send me a link to that report, and I'll do an analysis of it on Nuclear Green.
Well, we're working on it. We should have it soon. It's been kind of a frustration. But, yes, I will. If you go on to if you go on to Coalition for Energy Solutions websites, website is .org. One of the members of our group, Willem Post, has done a two-page kind of summary of some of the things in the report under the research research and report section. So it is available there. Our report isn't completely available, but his analysis is, and it's very nice and very good, and has some people very, very angry who've seen it.
Margaret, this is Dan, and one of the things that you might want to take a look at
Dan, just a minute. That's Meredith, by the way.
Meredith.
Yes.
Meredith.
Hi, Dan.
I have trouble with my consonants today. I don't know what the problem is.
I know how it is. I know how it is.
Margaret. Meredith. Sorry.
Yes.
The Telegraph in the UK had a very interesting report, which I think other people on this call have seen, that during their record cold snap, the air was very still, and they got absolutely no power from their offshore wind. Now, I have been to Vermont in the wintertime, 40 below. It froze my engine block, and there was no wind.
No, that is true. Actually,
it's a good thing there wasn't, isn't it?
One of the things that's a problem is that people begin looking at capacity factors for wind, and they go and they look at places like Denmark or along the coast of Maine, and sea winds are much more reliable than the kind of winds that you'd have on the ridges here, and that isn't factored into that report at all. They use the VPIRG report. They use capacity factors as if our ridges are sea winds, and you can look at wind maps and immediately see that they're just wrong, 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 but what are you going to do?
Keep fighting, keep repeating. Remember, the repeating technique that the antis have used is an effective technique. Unfortunately, those of us who are fact-based kind of believe that if we say something once and it's true, we don't have to keep repeating it. But the reality is, if you want to fight and you want to win, you got to be able to be repetitive.
Yes.
Yeah, and the other thing is that over time, if you bring facts in a non-emotional way, not trying to do fear-mongering, that kind of thing, and don't let them get to you, but you present the facts factually because they speak for themselves, and you do it over and over again, I have seen where you will get the antis to change their arguments because they realize that the things that when you can present factually that what they're saying is not true, they will abandon that tactic and move on to something else.
That's
but
true.
You have to be persistent to be able to achieve that.
What they do is they have fallback position B, and when you force them out of fallback position B, they go to fallback position C, and if you force them out of C, then they go back to fallback position A.
Right,
so,
and I'm not saying that they give up or that they stop arguing, but I have heard just egregious, really painful mistruths put out to members of the public as though they were fact. And when you call them on it and say the facts don't support that, and I'd have to question the source of your information because A and B and C, some of the really heinous stuff you don't have to hear over and over again if you call them on it. But if you let them stand and it works for them, then they'll keep using it.
Okay, folks. You know, this has been a lot of fun. I've enjoyed it tremendously, and we got to do it again sometime soon, but I'm looking at my clock saying it's been an hour and 16 minutes going so far, so I want to make sure people have a chance to listen to the whole thing, and maybe they'll listen to the whole thing again the next time we do one. So I want to thank you all for agreeing to come and talk and share your thoughts, and I want to also encourage you, learn the facts, keep repeating them. Don't be afraid to repeat them, but also don't be afraid to show that you really care about this issue enough to show a little emotion and to get, in some cases, if it feels like it feels right, get angry when somebody throws a bunch of baloney out at the table and expect for people to believe it.
Have a good night.
Yes. Thank you very much for inviting us.
Thank you, Rod.
It's always an honor and a privilege to be here, Rod. I really appreciate it. Hey, Meredith, that one website you were talking about, is that coalitionforenergysolutions.org?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Talk to you later then. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Goodbye. Goodbye, David. You still
there?
Have a good
one.
Take care. Thank you for showing up. Charles, take care. I'll be seeing you around the web.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adams way.
The podcast network is supported by Neo.org, a social network with a purpose, to transform the world by enabling people to transform themselves, and Tony Kynaston, our first TPN patron. Become a TPN patron or a member of the TPN 500 by visiting tpn.thepodcastnetwork.com.